But what I had thought to do from yesterday evening for this evening didn't happen. So I'm just going to continue from yesterday evening's discussion. Now, I see some people here who I know were not with us yesterday evening, so I'll do a little review. I was reading from the sixth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, or not reading from, but discussing from, and that was short. We were discussing Shukadev Goswami was being questioned by Maharaj Parikshit about the amazing situation of Vritrasura, who had been born out of a sacrificial fire that was created by Tvashta, one of the sons of Kashyapa and Aditi. Not our little Aditi, a different one.
She feels proud about it.
Yeah?
She's the mother of all the demigods.
The mother of all the demigods. Not quite. She's named after.
Yes.
We have to remind her to be humble, right?
Yes.
So, Tvashta, as was Kasyapa, Tvashta was a very powerful Brahmin. Just from Vedic mantras, he could create beings. And to chastise Indra, another one of the sons of Aditi, was Indra, to not just to chastise him, but to kill him because of his having killed the son of Tvashta mercilessly, literally without cause. And like you said, upstairs means more noise than downstairs. Yeah? Okay. It's a great design for a house where the parents can be down here and know what their children are doing upstairs. But for public programs, it doesn't. Anyway. Vritrasura was created from the Vedic Yajna fire as the enemy the enemy of Indra, who would be killed by Indra because of a mispronunciation of one syllable. Indra-chatro instead of Indra-chatroho. Just the opposite. So, Tvashta created this Vritrasura. So he was in the position of Asura, but he had the characteristics of the topmost stage of spiritual realization. He was an unalloyed devotee of the personality of Godhead. And the contrast we were discussing was Indra. I shouldn't say Indra. Those of you that are householders, you're used to hearing those sounds, but there are two sound vibrations that really, one is rap music, this because I can't stand to listen to it. Rap music and that sound. I guess it's good for a sannyasi to not like that sound, right? And it's good for everybody to not like rap music. It's just tamasic, terrible stuff. Anyway. Sorry if I cringe. This sixth canto we were discussing yesterday for review's purpose. It's a study of Dharma. The heading of the canto is Prescribed Duties for Mankind. So, what is our duty? Our duty is to be good and don't do bad. Many times I've been approached in public places dressed as a Hare Krishna devotee, and some very nice people, curious, four types of people, you know. One is jigyasu, they just want to know something about what you're doing. So they ask, you mind if I ask a personal question? No. Go right ahead. I know what they're going to ask. Are you with some religion? I'm with a baseball team. No. Yes, I'm with some religion. Do you mind if I ask what religion? The Hare Krishna movement. Oh, just like it happened on my way here at the St. Louis airport, the lady at the check-in counter. She looked at me like she knew me or something. She said, no. Are you a Buddhist monk?
No.
I said, not a Buddhist monk, but a monk. She said, oh, what religion? And I said, Hare Krishna. She said, oh, from the 1960s. Hare Krishna. I said, not from the 1960s, this is 2005. She said, oh, you're still thriving and doing well, that's very nice. And actually wrote my Vyas Puja to Prabhupada for the year, just commenting. I was thinking, as the conversation went on, yeah, do you have a center here in St. Louis? Yes, and where, and so forth. Oh, you're vegetarian, aren't you? Yeah, not only vegetarian, we offer everything that we eat first to Krishna. It's really nice. You should come sometime. So, I was thinking, Prabhupada was so powerful that, as he said, he had made the holy name of God a household word. Even people may not know. You know, who are you? Hare Krishna. Oh, Hare Krishna! He made Krishna a household word in America. And so many people, and it was a very positive feeling. Said, you people are so happy. You've given so much joy to so many people. This is very nice. I'm so happy to meet you today. This is the event of my day. You've made my day. Wow. Prabhupada ki jai. So, when people ask, what is your religion? I explain to them, if they ask, you know, what are the basic things that you believe in? And I know they're not hearing, because they're hearing through certain filters. Because a very common reply to that, whatever I say, is, oh, my religion is very much like that. I also believe in you do good to help other people, and you don't do bad things that hurt other people. That's not what I said, but that's what they heard. And so the duties of mankind, many people take to be acts of piety that lead to elevation. I did this in several venues. Recently, I was visiting in Houston. 2 weekends ago, I was in Houston, Texas. And we had a program in Sugar Land, where it's near the NASA complex. So the host was like, you know, one of the department heads of all the research. And his wife is the chairman of the biochemistry department of something, some university, and all their friends are of the same, you know, well-educated quality. So, I knew the response I would get before I spoke. What they wanted as a topic was, what are the Vedas and how to approach the Vedas, how to access the Vedas. I knew what, so I listen, how I began the class. Said, I know that a number of you are new to the Hare Krishna movement, so I just want to, like, do a little check-in here. How many of you would agree with the following statement? That the purpose of the Vedas is that you live by codes of good conduct so that you become situated in enjoying in this world, but in a pious and virtuous way, with the idea that you will gain natural benefits or, you know, piety in this life and prosper in this life, enjoy nicely, and after this life, you go to the heavenly planets. And they're all nodding. And then I said, can you just show your hands? And they all raised their hands. And I said, there's some other devotees here, and some of you that have read Srila Prabhupada's books, what would you say? You have a different idea, and they all had a different idea. They all had the same different idea. The purpose of the Vedas is to know Krishna. And you know Krishna by engaging in devotional service, and especially by chanting His holy name and dedicating everything to the service of Krishna. And that way, through that medium of devotional service, you come to know Krishna. And the purpose of the Vedas is like that. Vedaish desire vairaham eva vedyo vedanta krit veda vedeva chaham. So most people think that the prescribed duties of mankind are urdvam gacchanti sattvasta. You just become situated in goodness and you go to sattva or svarga. You go to a good place. You leave, you join nicely in this place and go up. The Bhagavatam in the sixth canto is teaching beyond goodness or shuddha sattva or the transcendental connection with our eternal relationship with the personality of Godhead. That's the message of the canto. The message of the canto is taught in the beginning by precept and then by example. Precept is there, the teaching is there. This is review from yesterday. Karma Kanda, Jnana Kanda, and Bhagavad Dharma. So there's different personalities who exemplify Karma Kanda and Jnana Kanda and then pure devotion. So in the case of Vritrasura, it's not the situation of the topmost stage of spiritual life is not connected to birth, not janma, as Krishna indicates in Bhagavad Gita, that the one's position in the varnashram system, varna, brahmana, kshatriya, vaishya, shudra, that's occupation, or ashram, brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas. It's not based upon janma. It's based upon guna and karma. Chaturvarnam, mayashrishtam, guna, karma, vibhagasha. So Vritrasura was disqualified because he was asura. Vritra, asura. And by the way, this is a little footnote. All of the stories in the Bhagavatam, all of the narrations in the Bhagavatam, are found in other places and other Puranas, except for this one. This Vritrasura narration is not found. It's what's described in the other Puranas as distinguishing the Bhagavat Purana from any other Purana. Because there's also Devi Bhagavat. There's Bhagavat Purana and there's Devi Bhagavat. And sometimes they're confused. So in Devi Bhagavat, this Vritrasura story isn't found. In fact, in Padma Purana and Kurma Purana and Matsya Purana and Adi Purana, none of the other Puranas. So this is a very special narration. And it's connected to what this is all review. What we're going to be discussing this evening is the unique position of Vritrasura as a pure devotee compared to Indra, who's a mixed devotee. He's a devotee, but he does the Indra syndrome. He does bad things because he becomes attached to his very strong material desires. He's very expert in karmakanda rituals, 100 Ashvamedha yajnas. You know, when Pitu was doing his Ashvamedha yajnas, Indra was stealing the last horse, so he wouldn't do 100 because he was thinking Pitu was wanting to equal him. Anyway, Indra has a number of issues with people over his material desires. And so, one of the lessons of the canto is that if you have lots of piety, but you don't have a pure heart, you got a problem. Because with piety comes the fruits of piety. And when there's fruits of piety, and there's an enjoying spirit instead of a pure devotion spirit, you're going to mix yourself with those fruits of piety and become attached in an enjoying spirit. And then when something comes along that seems to disturb that enjoyment, then one can do vicious things. Indra, infamous for it. It's not that Indra's a bad person. He's a good person. He's a very, very pious person. He's not only in heaven, he's the king of heaven. But so the message of the sixth canto is what's really required is pure hearts that have, by contact with devotional service to the Lord, which comes through the contact of a devotee of the Lord, one becomes free from the reactions of even the attraction for material enjoyment. And Vritrasura is one such person. Vritrasura is so absorbed in devotional service that he gives instructions to Indra how to take his own life using the thunderbolt weapon arranged by Lord Vishnu. So anyway, after hearing about the whole Vritrasura narration, Maharaj Parikshit asks the obvious question, How did this happen? To become a devotee, what to speak of a pure devotee, what to speak of a topmost platform, Mahabhagavata, pure devotee. It's so rare to find that. And before that happened, Vritrasura, he's in a demon body. How can you explain this? This is a great mystery. So, it's explained by describing his previous life. I'm raising my voice because there's no amplification and there's competition in the background. So, those of you in the front row that are hearing high volume, don't worry about it. So those in the back row can... That would help. Hare Krishna. At least they're not screaming. Okay. So, Shukadeva Goswami starts to explain who Vritrasura was in his previous life, and in his previous life he was a great king. A great, pious, powerful, very elevated religious king who had everything. A great kingdom, great power, great wealth, citizens that loved him, wonderful wife, Everything was great, except for one thing, because there's always something. It's this material world. There's always something. Always. And so the something was, he didn't have a son. And he was really attached to having a son. So skipping the details, Angira Muni, the direct son born from the body of Lord Brahma, great sage. He could understand the mind and the heart of the king, King Chitraketu, who is a famous king. So he went one time to visit his palace. We discussed this yesterday. And he was inquiring from the king, how are you doing? Everything, he went through the whole inventory of all the reasons why he should be completely satisfied. But he wasn't completely satisfied because he didn't have a son. So Angira considered, he tells him later, he comes back and visits later. And when he visits, he explains that I didn't give you transcendental knowledge at that time because you had beans in your ears. You couldn't hear. So I had to do something to relieve you of that condition.
He made an arrangement that he could have a son by special mantra in Vedic Yajna, Karmakanda, fulfill desires. And when desires are fulfilled by Karmakanda, what happens, the lesson is, you get what you want, but you also get involvement in the material energy. And involvement with the material energy means a mix of happiness and distress. Always. The other side of happiness is distress. It's just the nature of this place. It's by design. Dukkhalayam ashashvatam. It's just a design. It's got it right on the label. You buy the product and it says, this is going to cause you suffering. And still people buy it. It's the nature of the place. So he had a son, and Chitraketu, in order to have a son by other means, he kept marrying wives. According to the Srimad Bhagavatam, he had 10 million wives. For those of you that are married, think about it. Two wives, three wives, five wives, 10 wives. 100 wives. So those, it's not like when Krishna was married to 16,108 wives. Prabhupada invariably mentioned, and it's not like those wives were lamenting, when will I see Krishna? Another 16,799 days from now. No, Krishna expanded himself into identical Krishnas, identical forms. Vilas Vigraha forms, identical forms. And so in each and every palace, the queens were with Krishna every day. Chitraketu didn't do that. He didn't have that capacity. So the 9,999,999 co-wives, they were without a son. So in a impulsive moment of intense envy, they killed the one son. They poisoned him. And then they pretended like they were surprised when he was found dead the next morning. They lamented along with everybody else, including the queen. So that's our review. Now I want to read what the queen said. when the queen found the son dead, what happens to even pious people when the fruit of their piety disappears? Because they're pious, they turn to God. But not always do they turn to God with prayer. Sometimes they turn to God with accusations against God. Why have you done this? Like in Christianity, God, why have you forsaken me? Christ spoke like that. So Krita-dyuti spoke like that. Here's what Krita-dyuti said. O providence, O creator, alas, you are certainly inexperienced in creation. Really? For during the lifetime of a father, you have caused the death of his son, thus acting in opposition to your creative laws. Meaning, it's only natural. Fathers produce sons. The sons should survive, outlive the fathers. So what is the situation, O Creator, where the son dies before the father? This is contradictory. You are determined to contradict these laws. You are certainly the enemy of living entities. And never merciful. Pretty intense, huh? Prabhupada described that one of his godbrothers, one German professor, had visited India and became a disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So that German professor had told Prabhupada that during the Second World War, many Germans were praying to God, "Dear God, please send our sons or husbands or whatever, male members, back home." And the Allies, they were praying to God, "Please send our son, our father, or our husband back from the war." So, poor God, what a position. He's got to answer both prayers. And Prabhupada said, the German professor and scholar said that because many sons, fathers, and husbands didn't come back from the war, many people in Germany became atheists. God, they had a strong desire, so they approached God, some piety, please give us. And when that give us didn't happen, then God was to blame. You are inexperienced, you're not merciful, you don't know what you're doing, fie on you. And then, listen, this is another, she goes on. She's addressing God. My Lord! Of course, when one addresses one as my Lord, the attitude should be a little different than this one. You may say that there is no law that a father must die in this lifetime, in the lifetime of his son, and that a son must be born in the lifetime of his father. There's no rule like that, you might say. Since everyone lives and dies according to his own fruitive activity. That's a good argument. However, now she gives an atheistic argument. Karma Mimamsa argument. If fruitive activity is so strong that birth and death depend on it, then there is no need of a control of our God. You know Karma Mimamsa philosophy? Karma Mimamsa philosophy says, Karma Mimamsa philosophy says, there may be God, or there may not be God, it doesn't really matter. Karma Mimamsa philosophy says, what's supreme is the laws of karma. That's supposing there is a God. God, whoever he is, he just dispenses the laws of karma, and so karma is supreme, and so just do good duties,
and don't do bad, be good and don't do bad, and that's supreme. And if there's God, he's just a dispenser of that, and if there's no God, it doesn't matter either, anyway. You can worship God or not worship God, it's not so important. Do good and don't do bad. And that's our philosophy. It's an atheistic philosophy. God's a pawn of the laws of karma. Again, if you say that a controller is needed, this is a theistic argument to counteract or contradict Karma Mimamsa philosophy. If you say that a controller is needed because the material energy does not have the power to act alone, one may answer that if the bonds of affection you have created are disturbed by fruitive action, no one will raise children with affection. Meaning, what's the point of having a child? To raise a child, there must be affection for the child. So if that affection that you gave to raise the child gets disturbed by the fruitive activities of the child, where they get hurt, they die, there's a problem, then what's the use of having children and having affection for children that you gave the affection for? What kind of creator are you anyways? So he should take away from Prithiduti the opportunity to have a child, which was the initial plan anyways. But she wanted to counteract that plan with her plan. And that's the way of, it's certainly the way of atheism, and it's also, anyway, karma kanda. I have a certain, in this life, each one of us, we have a certain amount of enjoyment and a certain amount of suffering due to our past karma. So, if we make our whole life trying to increase our enjoyment, it's not going to happen unless the karma permits it to happen. Some people try very, very hard to get something they want, and they don't get it. And some people hardly make any effort, and just like that, they get it. Why? There's behind that endeavor, there's some stockpile or lack of it of karma. The piety that entitles one to receive something. So her argument is, supposing you receive something, and then, you know, there's this other factor, the God factor, that, you know, there's a living entity that's the object of your enjoyment, and they disappear off your radar screen because of their karma. Then who's going to want to speak of have children? Who's going to want to have relationships with anybody? Because at any moment, that happiness can turn into suffering. So she doesn't like, she doesn't like the lesson of creation, because the lesson of creation is, the big slate says, the lesson of creation is, this isn't a place for enjoyment. There is another place for enjoyment, that's where things are eternal. This place is not, it's by design, it's not a place for enjoyment. But she and Chitraketu are very determined to be enjoyers. So she turns to her son, or at least the body of her son, and she starts speaking like a mad person to her son. She gives three different arguments why he should come back. The first argument she gives is that she and her husband, Chitraketu, they're suffering too much.
How'd it get up there? I don't either.
I'm helpless and very much aggrieved. You should not give up my company.
just look at your lamenting father. He's lying on the floor, unconscious. Tears, had pools of water, puddles of tears on the floor. Completely, his clothes in complete disarray. The king, the pious king, smashed by his emotional ruination, the loss of his son. Just see. Of course, the boy's dead, so he's not seeing. We are helpless because without a son, we shall have to suffer the distress of going to the darkest hellish regions. You are the only hope by which we can get out of these dark regions. Therefore, I request you, please come back. That didn't work, so she tries the next line of argumentation. He said, all your friends, they're calling for you to come and play. Come and enjoy with your friends. You were always so happy in their company. Please come back. No answer. So then she tries another tact, another line of argument. My dear son, I can no longer see your smiling face. You have closed your eyes forever. I can no longer hear your pleasing voice. Please come, let me feed you. Her motherly affection is the third argument. No response. She throws herself to the floor and does something like that. And just at that moment, very timely, two sages arrive, ready to give a Bhagavad Gita class to Chitraketu and Kritadyuti. Wow. It's been a long time since I've had competition like this during the class. It's a test of something. So, Chitraketu, overcome with lamentation, lay like a dead body at the side of the dead body of his son. While he was in that devastated condition, they began to speak. So when you find someone, this is a nice lesson, when you find someone that's so lost in lamentation, if you just speak, you don't even know if they're hearing or not hearing. So they ask him a question. Now, when someone's in deep lamentation, they can't respond. But something starts to stir. So this is what they did. They asked, O King, what relationship does the dead body for which you lament have with you? There's the dead body. There you are. What's the relationship? And what relationship do you have with him? You may say that you are now related as father and son. But do you think this relationship existed before? Like before he became your son? Does it truly exist now? And will it exist in the future? What's the nature of a body-to-body relationship is the question. O King, now to help him understand, he gives a metaphor. Can something be done? It's too much. I mean, a little bit is a little bit. Can somebody do something? So, he gives a metaphor. He gives two metaphors. One of the metaphors he gives is a metaphor of particles of sand that are moved by the motion of the waves of the ocean. So in the ocean, there's so many particles of sand, and the waves of the ocean churn. And as the waves of the ocean churn, some particles of sand bump into one another. And the same waves of the sand, they separate those particles of sand. Do you lament when that happens, my dear king? Similarly, the living entities who have accepted material bodies sometimes come together and sometimes separate by the force of time. When Hiranyakashipu is pacifying Diti, not Aditi this time, but Diti, and the relatives of Hiranyaksha, when Hiranyaksha has been killed by Brahadeva, he gives the same type of example, but he uses a different... In fact, there's several places. So here's another one. Hiranyakashipu's example is, sometimes persons go to an inn. We don't have this so much here in America. Or to a place where they gather water for the morning. There's a very nice place in Vrindavan by... In Vrindavan, there's a lot of the water that comes from the ground is salty. It's just not potable. You can't drink it. So our Food for Life facility in our Krishna Balaram Mandir, they've helped in some places where they don't have fresh water to find wells, make wells where they have fresh water. So you go to those places and early in the morning, all the ladies are carrying these giant pots on their head. I don't know how they carry them with their, they're so full. And they go and fill up the water. And while they're there filling up the water, what are they doing? They're talking with one another. And then that's it for the day, and they go back to their place, and they don't see each other till the next morning, and then it's... So, as we're gathering water, and then there's dispersing, you go to the place, the inn, you take some refreshment, and you meet somebody there, and then you scatter. Or another metaphor that he gives, particles of straw that are moving in a swirl of water in a whirlpool. So in the body of water floating down a river, you've seen just something floating on, and then there's a place where the water swirls around, and so those same particles, they for some time they gather together. The force of the river, they move downstream and then they disperse again. So like that. Through the force of the material energy, some persons come together. Family members, friends, some kind of relation, community. This happens in Seattle all the time. People come and people go, right? They get a job, they stay for some time, their job shifts, and off they go. Right? You were just telling me. So many people come and from your Bhakti Vriksha group. And transient population. What to speak of, anyway, San Jose is just even, it's even shorter. Silicon Valley. So, what is that? What is that relationship? They're probing. It's a temporary arrangement due to the forces of time and the material energy. What's the real relationship? You're thinking it's the relationship of father and mother to son. Let's consider this father and mother business. When seeds are sown in the ground, so like, you know, tulsi seeds, or it's springtime, maybe you're planting your garden. There are seeds, and you plant the seeds in the ground. Sometimes they grow into plants. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes the ground is not fertile and the sowing of the seeds is unproductive. Similarly, sometimes a prospective father impelled by the potency of the Supreme Lord can beget a child, but sometimes conception does not take place.
And therefore, one should not lament over the artificial relationship of parenthood, which is ultimately controlled by the Supreme Lord. So they were lamenting they didn't have a child. Now they're lamenting because the child came and went. Who is the controller around here anyways? And who is the enjoyer? If one is the controller, that person is the enjoyer. The problem is, we're trying to be the controller and enjoyer, and it's not our position. The motion of the river, the motion of time, these are forces that are controlling things, not us. It is by the Supreme... This is Prabhupada's purport. It is by the Supreme Will that we are situated in certain conditions. In terms of family, community, and personality. These are all arrangements of the Supreme Lord according to our desires, under the spell of Maya, or illusion. In devotional life, here's our practical instruction. Therefore, one should not desire anything, meaning apart from the Supreme Lord, since everything depends upon the personality of Godhead. One should act only to develop Krishna consciousness. In other words, like this notion that there's a certain amount of happiness and suffering that's due, do we need to preoccupy ourselves with, I want more suffering and more enjoyment, less suffering? Supposing you want it the other way around, you're not going to get it anyways. You're allotted a certain amount. So, where should your attention go? This is the lesson. Where should your attention go? Go to pleasing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Whatever enjoyment you're due, whatever suffering you're due, it will come. What about your eternal, what about the well-being of the eternal soul? That's the lesson of Bhagavad Dharma. Do your duties nicely, and karma evadikarase ma paleshu kadachana. You're not entitled to the fruits. Who's entitled to the fruits? The enjoyer and controller is entitled to the fruits. Then what is your dharma? Serve the Supreme Lord. That's the lesson that Angira and Narada are imparting. O King, and O fellow devotees, both you and us, so included Angira, Narada, and the king, your advisors, your wives, your ministers, as well as everything moving and not moving throughout the entire cosmos at this time, are in a temporary situation. Like, now you see it, now you don't. Like, here's a hat. Nothing in the hat. Here comes a rabbit out of the hat. Look at that, there's a rabbit. Put it back in the hat, he's gone. What happened? Now we're seeing, we're all in some relation with one another. That a few moments pass and it's gone. Now you see it, now you don't. What's the reality of that relation? Isn't there something that's more durable? And because it's eternal, more significant where your attention should go, O King? Now, we all agree to this. Everyone's nodding yes, it's true. But, do we live our lives that way? We live our lives saying yes and doing something else. Now, this is a very important understanding, practical understanding in life. What is the purpose behind calamity? Sages understand it's a great time to present reality with a capital R. Like, from the previous part of this same canto, my voice is still up, but the kids stop screaming. So, they'll start again. Very predictable. When Narada
took the 10,000 and then the 1,000 sons of Daksha into his bhakta program. He went to visit Daksha, telling Daksha, guess what, I've got some great news for you. Your sons have joined my bhakta program. You sent them to go engage in austerities so they can become good prajapatis to assist you in your prajapati program, but they've joined the bhakta program. Knowing what the reaction of Daksha would be. Daksha was fried. Daksha was angry. In that moment of having an expectation that doesn't happen, one becomes frustrated. Those moments of frustration, a sadhu knows, it's a very good time when disappointment and hopes for happiness with the temporary come to pass. It's a great opportunity for hearing about the eternal. Where is real shelter when this false shelter is unavailable? The whole thing was set up by Angira to help Chitraketu hear what he's now hearing. Because when he was still hoping for the happiness, he was climbing the mountain. Well, when he got on the top of the mountain and looked around and saw that I'm about to fall off, and then he fell. Then he's ready to hear about the alternative. You follow? When someone's holding on very tightly to a misconception, it's hard to give them a spiritual conception. We've all tried it. A very materialistic person, to give them a spiritual conception when they're holding on, very difficult. But the reversals of the material energy are there to help tighten the grip on the material conception so that one can give consideration to an alternative, a spiritual conception. So that's what they're... Here they're just giving gyan. Before it was karmakanda, now it's gyan. And there's some relief with gyan, but it's not sufficient. So that this body lying before us is not really our son, it's a temporary arrangement by material nature, and then that temporary arrangement is taken away by the same action of time. Then what? What do we have to take shelter of? Take shelter of the soul, the spiritual conception. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Master and proprietor of everything, is certainly not interested in the temporary cosmic manifestation, nonetheless. Another metaphor. Just as a boy at the beach creates something, sandcastle in the sand, in which he is not interested. He walks, after he builds it, he walks away. The Lord, keeping everything under his control, creates, maintains, and annihilates. He creates by engaging the Father to beget a son. He maintains by engaging a government or a king to see to the public's welfare. And he annihilates through the agents for killing, such as snakes. The agents for creation, maintenance, and annihilation have no independent potency. Where do they get that potency? From the Supreme. But because of the spell of the illusory energy, one thinks oneself the creator, the father, the maintainer. By my hard work, I'm maintaining. And the annihilator. I get angry, so I destroy something. But where does that ability come from to do any one of those? Who is the real father here? Krishna. You're suffering because you forgot Krishna. Oh, king. He's like, he's on a roll here. As from one seed, like from the tree, this is the springtime, so many flowers have come out from the trees and flowers, and Then there's these little pods, and in these pods there are some seeds. In the seeds there's another tree, or the potential of a fruit that produces some seeds. Within the seed, another seed is generated. And so from one body, the father, through another body, the mother, a third body is generated. As the elements of the material body are eternal, the living entity who appears through these material elements is also eternal. So what's going on? Who is the father? Eternal elements. There's the seed that didn't come from you. It came from your father. And there's the body of the child. Who's the father here? And Krishna is still the father of that living entity. So what are you lamenting for? Attachments, breaking of attachment through transcendental knowledge is confronting illusion. Divisions. Here's an interesting sentence. Divisions of generalization and specification, such as nationality, that's a generalization, and individuality, are all the imaginations of persons who are not advanced in knowledge. So it's gyan. He's giving gyan leads to vairagya. This couplet is always there in Vedic wisdom. Gyan vairagya. Gyan vairagya. Gyan vairagya. No vairagya. There must be something missing. The teaching of Bhagavad Dharma is not Gyan Vairagya, but Yukta Vairagya. So you know the difference? Gyan is that this is Gyan. Knowledge, what is matter, what is spirit, who is the controller of both, this is knowledge. But when you have one who actually has knowledge, Bahunam Janmanante Gyanavan Mam Prapadyate. The person who actually has knowledge surrenders to the Supreme Lord. What is that knowledge that they have that precipitates the surrender? Vasudev Sarvamiti. Samahatma Sadurlabha. So Angira is just helping to prepare for the Bhagavad Dharma lesson that Narada is going to give next. This is the Gyan lesson, following the Karmakanda lesson. Detachment is incomplete through knowledge alone. Some detachment will be there. After, that was the last statement in this little session. After that session, Shukadeva Goswami says, Angira gets up off the floor. He was smashed by his emotions. He looks around and sees these two sages that have just spoken so eloquently. And he offers, with folded hands, he offers great words of praise and prayer. Such wonderful words you've spoken. So powerfully they've acted upon my heart. My anxiety and grief are greatly dissipated. Can you indicate to me who are both of you wonderful sages? So I gave a little preview to this yesterday. Angira says, don't you recognize? I'm the one that performed this yajna so you could have your son. Your lamentation has been so intense, you don't even know who you are, who I am. This the intense desire, Kamesha, Krodesha, Rajogun Samudbhava. Intense desire and longing, which is a symptom of passion, leads to ignorance, lamentation, and great suffering. It always follows. Prabhupada's words are, frustration and suffering are the younger brother of the same mother. Rajoguna is the mother, and the firstborn is Kama. The next one is Krodha. They're brothers. Older brother, younger brother. The younger brother follows the older brother. Always. So what to do to relieve that passion? Transcendental knowledge. At least to get a foothold, a beginning. So Angira said, my dear king, I would have given you this transcendental knowledge before, but you weren't ready to hear it. So I made an arrangement so you were ready to hear it. And what is that arrangement? Pow! Because you couldn't hear it before. So that sometimes when a sage acts like that, or the material energy acts like that under the direction of God, there's a purpose behind it. It's to teach the lesson. This is not the position of happiness. What is that verse? Yehi samsparshaja bhoga dukkha yonaya evate. Bhoga means what you keep in your refrigerator before it's offered to Krishna. You go to, one of the first services I did when I joined the temple is I was trained to go to the bhoga market. I said, what's that, a bhoga market? It's a produce market. But that which is before it's offered to Krishna, that's the devotee language. They called it the bhoga market. Anyway. That which is not yet offered to the Supreme, that's bhoga. And if you try to enjoy that which is not first offered to the Supreme, that's bhoga. Sense enjoyment. Bhoga, aishvarya. Prasaktanam, those who are asakti, those who are attached to enjoying apart from the Supreme. Bhogaishvarya prasaktanam. That's a different verse. Yehi samsparshaja bhoga. Yes, sir. By trying to be the enjoyer of objects, samsparshaja bhoga. By contacting the senses with sense objects. Dukkha, yonaya evate. Yoni means place of birth, like a womb. The place of birth of dukkha is that moment of anticipation of enjoyment. Whoa. Consider that for a moment. As long as I'm in that space where my senses are going out into the world thinking, I will enjoy if my senses contact this sense object. That's dukkha yoni. It's the birthplace of distress. It's a bad bargain. It's buying a used car when it says on the used car, the alternator doesn't work, that the generator doesn't work, the engine has seized, the oil pan has a leak, and $5,000, please. No, thank you. It doesn't work. It's going to be misery. Don't buy it. But people buy it all the time. The source of misery. They buy into it again and again with such determination. Bilvamangala Thakur he became a great devotee when he was told by the prostitute Chintamani, if you had the determination for Krishna that you have for sense gratification, you'd be a pure devotee. Well, like I was describing to someone today who was asking, how do I chant with great attention and determination? My answer was, if you knew that your job was dependent, you'd lose your job unless you did a certain thing Would you be applying yourself? You wouldn't have to ask, how do I do that? You'd be doing that certain thing. Not how do I do it. You do it by determination. You put your mind to it. How do I pay attention to chanting? Give your attention. You make it your mission. A burning desire. So as we have strong material desires, let our material desires become so fueled with determination and attention. Like our life depended on it, and our spiritual life does depend on it. You're standing in the middle of a railroad track and there's a train coming, roaring at you, and you know, what should I do now? Should I go left or right? You don't stop and ask those questions. You fail. Immediately. Your life depends on it. And our spiritual life similarly depends upon our devotional enthusiasm. And those that have devotional enthusiasm, the how-to is easy. The scriptures are filled with the how-tos. It's just having the determination to do so. Application. I think I'll end with this note, just a kind of armchair thing. It's very interesting. The life of a sannyasi is a very interesting life. It's a natural life for detachment, and as sannyas life is supposed to do, it gives an opportunity for a whole variety of experiences. And I can just give you a little, you know, one little snippet of a little realization that I have from visiting by choice. I visit the same places regularly. I don't try to visit all places because I spend my whole life doing that and still not do them all. So those places where I go regularly, like, you know, when was the last time I was here? In
October.
So some 6 months, something like that. Over and come again another time, and come again another time, and over. So you're all living with each other, and you don't notice the incremental changes, but I notice over several months some significant changes. Some of the children are getting bigger, and some of the adults are getting wiser, and some are staying in the same place. So what's the difference between those that are making progress and those that are staying in the same place? There's two very significant criteria. One of them just is a simple word, it's application. What goes in the ear goes into the heart, and then you apply it in practical ways in your life, just like in your bhakti riksha groups. The last thing that comes in the sequence of activity that you do in a bhakti riksha group is application. It's not just a time-consuming exercise. It's the most critical part. It's not just you get the you're all educated persons that can get A's on exams. You can get A's on the exam when someone says, "What's an application point?" But doing it makes the difference between making progress and not progressing. And one of the things that impedes application is just being lazy, complacent, and you're comfortable. Nice, I have nice association, nice company, maybe a little insecurity because who knows what's going to happen with the economy, but kind of secure and everything's okay. Krishna! So don't wait for the right, don't wait for that. For advancement, be very careful and consistent and diligent and conscientious to apply. It's not that you can apply everything all the time. It's circuit overload. But those things that you really understand and value, apply them very carefully and consistently. Take one thing and apply it very consistently, and you'll see that so many other things, it becomes easy. Just do one thing that you know, find one thing. Just like chant with great attention early in the morning. We're all convinced about that one. Do it consistently. Chant with great attention early in the morning. Great attention every morning. Every morning, bring your mind back, absorb your, pray, just work on it with great enthusiasm and intensity. And so many other things that you know are important to do, they'll follow. I think I'll just end on that note. There's nice instructions in the Bhagavatam, and the purpose of these nice instructions is that you apply them. Like, you know, another one of the common questions for as a sannyasi is, Maharaj, it's really nice when you or other sannyasis come to town and we feel so inspired and so uplifted, and then they go away and some time passes and it's business as usual. How can we like stay enlivened and inspired and stay in that consciousness? Common question. It's the same answer. Those things that you've gained, apply them. Carry them in your heart. Learn that art of taking that sangha and putting it right in the core of your heart. Remember the instructions. Live by those instructions. Shrinvanti, Gayanti, Grinanti, Sadhavaha. It's a phrase that in the poetry of the Bhagavatam appears several times because it's a very important phrase. The hearing and chanting, we say, you know, yes, Khan, hearing and chanting. How's your hearing and chanting? Shrinvanti, Gayanti, but I'm addressing the determination of that hearing and chanting quality is how well you're applying. Grinanti, take it within your heart. And if you value that association, you take that association within your heart through those instructions, through the messages that you hear. How do you think those who were initiated disciples of Srila Prabhupada that no longer have Prabhupada's association, how is Hari Vilas doing it? You ever ask yourself that question? How did he do it? He's like, he doesn't tire. He's tireless. Tireless Hari Vilas. You know, just at any moment, you just bring a philosophical question to Hari Vilas and he's got his Bhagavad Gita open with 50 pages of notes, and he's in ecstasy, even though he's just been absorbed in, you know, solving a problem or working on his business or whatever it is. He's always there. He's always with Prabhupada, isn't it? Always. 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 That's what's sustaining him. Where does he get that energy that he's got? From that connection, that spiritual connection. You carry that association within your heart. And you practically apply those messages. Okay, so, 9:15. Any discussion? And if not, I'm going to go to where the deities are in Hemarti. Should we go? Hare Krishna.
Maharaj, I'll make one quick announcement. Maharaj is going to have a special children's program Friday evening when children's Bhagavatam. Sannyas. And after 40-45 minutes, children will be asked to go upstairs and make noise, and we'll again be
sitting in the backyard and make noise, how about that?
In summer Friday, Jitendra will be in our email.
Shri the Prabhupada ki jai.